Twofootedtackle.com.
Willkommen zur Das Two-Footed Tackle Podcast. Yes, hello and welcome to a very special Germany-themed pod as we get the beer, Bratwurst and Bundesliga ready to talk all things Deutsche Fußball. Also on the pod, Rangers players prepare for the career outside football by passing their bus parking exam. Also, Golden Balls returns in the MLS. Chris Nee heads off in a hoof as Villa lose to Stoke. All that and more on the Two-Footed Tackle Podcast. Yes, hello and welcome to the Two Footed Tackle Podcast. I'm Gary Andrews, and before you ask, yes, this is a 1977 replica Borussia Dortmund strip I'm wearing tonight. It's a very fine strip indeed. Joining me on the pod, as ever, Chris Nee. Hello, Chris. How's tricks?
Hello. Looking very fetching over there.
Thank you. It spoke to me when I saw it in the shop last
what
weekend.
What did it say?
It said buy me, mainly. And so I did. And now I'm wearing it. First outing in it as well.
Is that better than the luminous efforts of the 90s, you think?
Yes, I'm not a massive fan of luminous strips. I don't know if you've seen Exeter City's goalkeeping strip. It's bright luminous yellow, and it really, really like glow in the dark. And they had, for a brief period of time, we had an away strip which was pink for the goalkeeper, and he had to play at Millwall in a pink away strip.
Brave
luminous
man.
Pink.
Brave man.
Had a good game as well, actually. Also on the pod, Terry DeFellin from the Sound of Football podcast and the Bundesliga. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Gary.
How you doing?
I'm really well, thank you.
Excellent.
I'm not wearing my Dortmund strip that I bought there. My Dortmund strip doesn't fit you as well as snugly as that. As well as that yours does. Yours is. As soon as you stepped out of the changing rooms I thought, my God, it's Gary. So we made him buy it.
It could have got. Yeah, I could have been a player on the pitch in 1977, just the way that.
You could have been.
Yeah, need to work on the hair, perhaps a little bit more. On there. Last but by no means least, the brains of the pod, Cynical Challenge and ITV Football's James Appel. Hi, James.
Hi, Gary. Hi, listeners. Nice to be here.
Great. How are you doing?
I'm well. I'm feeling really good now you've referred to me as the brains of the pod. Although I think that reflects a lot worse on you than it does well on me.
Okay. Well, we'll start out on the continent, first off, because it's a rare European weekend we have first-hand experience of. The Bundesliga. The past few seasons have been down to the wire classics, and just three games in, Germany's top flight is shaping up for another cracker of the season. Terry, the table in the Bundesliga at the moment, three games in, has a very distinctly topsy-turvy look to it, doesn't it?
Mm. Well, there are shades of 2007 with Hoffenheim at the top. 2008, sorry, with Hoffenheim at the top, who won the Winter Championship when they were first promoted into the Bundesliga. The Winter Championship is won at the end of the first half of the season before the winter break. And Hoffenheim came up from the Bundesliga, had a fantastic start to the season, and then they kind of tailed off. They did nothing last season, finished mid-table, but this season they've had a stonking start to the season, and they beat Schalke last Friday 2-0, a much fancied Schalke.
And we saw some of that.
We saw pretty much all of it. Although we saw the second half first, thanks to the vagaries of Sky Deutschland's scheduling, they showed the game, which we only saw the second half. Got in time to watch the second half, which was great. But then we stayed after a while, and then they just repeated the game again. So we watched a lot of the first half as well. And Hoffenheim played really, really well. Schalke, not so well at all. Schalke have got some injury problems and some issues bedding in new players after a big squad overhaul.
Huntler missed a couple of excellent chances for Schalke.
I think Huntler could have had a hat-trick, yeah. In fairness, you could argue that he's lacking a bit of sharpness. And maybe he's still establishing a relationship with Raul. I'm not certain how Raul fits into Magath's tactical plan. I'm not totally convinced that Magath has one at the moment. I think he's brought in all these players, and I wonder whether he's had to sort of look at them and go, right, now I've got to figure out how to actually make them play. It could be a little while before we see Schalke sort of really start to play, but I'm certain they've got a massive game on Sunday. Against Borussia Dortmund, their big rivals. So that is going to be an epic encounter, and they really do need to win that. I'm thinking of actually putting some money on a Schalke win, because everybody will be saying that Dortmund are going to win that game.
And speaking of Dortmund, we were at the Westfalenstadion, and Dortmund looked very, very good. against Steve McLaren's Wolfsburg. You have to say Wolfsburg were very poor in the second half once they went a goal down.
Wolfsburg possibly suffering from the same problem that Schalke are suffering from, and that's again a changeover in players. Diego is in, Musimovic is out, Dzeko was leaving and then he's not leaving and then he's staying. They've got the two guys, Chiara and Friedrich, at the back, who are not quite working quite well. Chiara particularly is not working that well. So you could argue that Wolfsburg are still bedding in. They do score goals, though. They've scored 4 goals in 3 games, so they should be okay. And they were a little bit unlucky in the first half, in fairness. But Dortmund were epic, were brilliant in the second half. And Nuri Sahin, the young Turkish-German player, made his debut for Dortmund at 16, attacking midfield playmaker. If he stays at Dortmund, then they are going to be a real force over the years to come, because he's just going better and better and better as a player. And his first goal, as you well know, Gary, because you saw it, was truly spectacular. It was Bild's goal of the day, in fact.
It was indeed. The second goal was no less enjoyable.
Yeah, that was the one that I saw.
Yes. Terry happened to be in the queue for the beer, because wonderfully at the German stadiums you can drink beer in the ground.
Yes.
And the perils of that is you get stuck in queues at half time.
You do indeed. Yeah.
Terry missed the fantastic first goal. You've got to say, though, with Wolfsburg, they were lacking coherency. I mean, McLaren's obviously a new coach. He's brought in a lot of new faces. But how much pressure will he be under for Wolfsburg?
Well, according to Wolfsburg's general manager, Dieter Hönes, he's under no pressure whatsoever.
Which means
he's probably under an intense amount of pressure because he started so badly that he's had to force his boss to go out on TV and say that there's no problem, which you don't really want to be putting your boss in that kind of situation. You want your boss to be as quiet as possible. So when you're getting a general manager out making sort of like, don't worry, everything's fine kind of comments, then I suggest that the pressure is on them. But I don't think Wolfsburg are necessarily the kind of club that will get rid of him very soon with indecent haste. But I mean, if they're not up in, I would say, maybe top 6-7 by Christmas, then I think there might be some problems.
What do you think have been the problems for Wolfsburg? I mean, you know, after last season at FC Twente, I think everyone thought that McLaren had the Midas touch. So what's gone wrong early on?
Well, McLaren's apparently his masterstroke at Twente was to change nothing and just simply take over. It was a perfectly good squad and just carry on. He's had to make changes because there have been players who have wanted to leave, and they needed to reshape the defence. That's why he signed Arne Friedrich and Simon Kjær. And there was this whole deal with Musimovic, who had enough and wanted to go, and the issue of Dzeko as well. So he's had to make some fairly key changes, and it's possible that that's what it is. He has made a couple of strange remarks publicly as well, which people are suggesting that perhaps he's underestimated the quality as well of the league. Maybe he's read too many English papers and believes the whole myth about is sort of like the superiority of the English game. I'm not sure about that. I just think he's been very unlucky. They could have got a point at Bayern very, very easily. They lost in the last minute in the first game of the season. They were 3-0 up against Mainz. You know, on a different day, they would never have lost that game, you know, from 3-0 up. So you could argue that perhaps last Saturday was their first poor, genuinely poor performance. But there's no wins in the win column.
I mean, one thing I was surprised about, all the talk pre-match at Dortmund, was Diego, who returned to Germany from after a spell at Juventus.
Yeah.
And he was, again, he was poor, petulant, lucky not to see red as well after a kick on, I think, one of the defenders in front of the Dortmund
In front of the Sud Tribune. 24,000 Dortmund fans saw it and pointed it out to the referee. And the next thing you know, Diego is in the book. And it could have been worse because it was seriously off the ball. Although it wasn't damaging, it was a petulant off the ball kick out at a player, and something that Diego has done in the past. He's got a very short fuse. It's interesting how you gain when you watch a player on the television, and only on the television, you kind of get a sort of like perception of him, and you think, oh, Diego, you love watching Diego, he's a fantastic player when he's in full flow. But then when you watch him in a game situation, when you're actually there and watching him there, you realise what an absolute git the guy can be. And he really was. He was ornery and petulant and obdurate and many, many other three syllable, you know, words that I couldn't come up with to describe him. You know, he wasn't the sort of like superstar suddenly. He just looked like, you know, he reminded me of Vinnie Samways from the 1990s, only, you know, considerably more
damned
talented.
Damned with faint praise there.
But Samways was like that. He was a guy on television who was like, ooh, look at me, you know. But when he saw him live, he was like, he was always chattering in the ref's ear. He was always elbowing and, oh, well, because then.
Because I mean, I remember
if he's
watching.
Listening, I'm sorry, Vinny. I'll buy you a drink, you know.
I remember watching Diego last season at Juventus in his first few games, and I thought he looked fantastic. He looked like a genuinely world class player. And then it just, for whatever reason, Juve obviously had a very poor season last season, and he looks like he's carried that poor form over into Germany as well. Obviously the big team in Germany is Bayern Munich, and we saw as well part of their draw with Bremen, and you've got to say, I mean, that was actually. Bayern had good spells, but Bremen looked like a very, very decent side this season in the Bundesliga. Are you expecting them to be up there?
I don't think they'll win the Bundesliga, but I think that they're certainly the top three contenders. I was surprised that they looked as well organised as they did. Bayern played Evika Olic. I was going to say Mesut Özil. That's not correct. Bayern played Evika Olic up front. Which when Olic usually plays sort of in the supporting three behind, say, Gomez. But Van Gaal, I don't know whether that's the first time he did it, he put him up front. And Bremen did quite a good job of isolating him from Ribery and the other players, and Schweinsteiger and Müller. And so that kind of throttled them a bit. So it didn't look good. They couldn't come up with anything going forward. Bremen, in fairness, could actually have won that game. And they played Marco Arnautovic, who's an Austrian striker who has come from Palermo. He's a precocious talent, has a bit of a reputation in the dressing room. But he looked really, really good. He was really good against Sampdoria in the Champions League quarterfinal. And they've got Marco Marin, who I think is going to be having a, but he came to our attention two seasons ago when he came up with Mönchengladbach. A winger, very, very pacey, very nippy, very tricky, very diminutive though, and he went down like a sack of potatoes, very easy, but not easy, didn't require much encouragement to go down. Last season he moved to Bremen, more of the same, still very much a peripheral figure, but this season I think he's because he showed up in the game against Tottenham quite a lot. And I think that he's beginning to mature, and this could be a breakthrough season with Bremen in the Champions League and Marco Marin really coming through. Then this could be a breakthrough season for Marin. And so they're definitely contenders, although I still think that you would always look in the Bundesliga, your money will always have to go on Bayern because, you know,
it's Bayern.
That's Bayern.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come back to the Bundesliga at various points during the season, but it'd be fascinating to see if three of the clubs who expect to do well, Wolfsburg, Schalke and Stuttgart, all on nil points. Be interesting to see if they can turn it around. Be interesting to see if any of the Hoffenheim, Mainz and Hanover, all of whom not expected to do great things this season, be interesting to see if they can stay up there. Well, as well as popping over to Dortmund, Terry and I also stopped by Köln 2 against Bochum 2. Now, that's nominally a fourth-tier game, but these are also actually the reserve sides of the bigger teams. They compete against other reserve sides in the pyramid of the German league, also feeds up into sort of third tier, second tier. And there's also sort of proper teams, not reserve teams, in there. It's a very interesting concept. What did you make of this fourth tier game that you went to, Terry?
Well, it was an interesting experience because I think the game itself took place in Cologne's, FC Cologne's training complex, which has a small stadium, the Franz Kramer Stadium. And it's a four star degree where one side of it is seated, the rest of it is all terraced. And it's very modern. And it was a bit like watching a non-league match. Only the standard of football, I would argue, was probably quite a bit better because these were, you know, certainly potential first and second division players. Maybe not quite up to standard, hence being in the reserves. But I thought it was a charming experience. I really, really enjoyed it. And it felt like I was watching a bit of a non-league game, only fourth division, slightly different.
Chris, do you think that kind of concept could ever catch on over here, or should it ever catch on over here?
It is an interesting one. It kind of begs the question where these teams would go. So we're probably looking at takeovers. and other such difficult concepts as that. It would be great, I think, to have reserve players having more competitive football, because the reserve league doesn't quite cut it as that kind of level. But English football is such, and it's so deep, that it would be difficult to place the teams that would be going in from the bigger clubs.
Would it perhaps be something like, say, Manchester City have got that this tie-up with Hyde United, of maybe sort of blooding one or two of the younger players, or offering those younger players who haven't had a chance, and who Manchester City don't think you're going to make it, rather than just going, right, we're releasing you, fend for yourselves out there. Actually going, right, we're going to, you know, you've got an option to go to Hyde if you want, rebuild your career there, benefits Hyde, benefits the player.
I would be in favour of that, and I think that's probably, to a certain extent, part of what that deal will include. 11 players, however, I'm not so sure about. Because these clubs are, you know, they have history and values of their own, so they're not going to just want 11 Premier League reserves airlifted in.
Mm. James, what do you make of it? Because obviously Rafa Benitez made comments about this a couple of years ago, saying, you know, we should have our reserves playing in the Championship or what have you. It's quite common over in Spain as well with the B teams. Where do you stand on it?
The idea of a competitive league structure in which reserve teams can compete is obviously one that I feel would be beneficial. The only problem comes, funnily enough, when these teams get entered into cup competitions. There was an occurrence a while back in Holland. I think that what ended up happening, and hopefully if I get this wrong, somebody who's listening in can correct me on this. Ajax Amsterdam and Ajax second team ended up drawing one another, and I think the semi-finals of the Dutch Cup, which led to an enormous kind of, let's say, constitutional problem with Dutch football, in that which team would be so-called allowed to win, and should the unthinkable happen and Ajax's second team beat, you know, their sort of superiors, would the second teamers be allowed to play in the final, or would Ajax sort of nominally demote a load of their first teamers to allow them to play in the second team in the final of a major competition with a European qualifying place at stake? So, whilst I sort of accept that there are benefits and positives, we all know that the FA Cup is essentially a kind of welcoming all comers sort of competition, and there could be serious consequences for allowing reserve teams to compete on a level playing field in that.
I suppose, I mean, that raises two points that immediately spring to my mind. The first one being is that you would have a registration process for the FA Cup for the players, and say, well, look, no, you're playing for this team, sorry mate. So that you do get the cup tie rule, don't you, for FA Cup. So you may not necessarily have that trafficking, if you like, of players, you know, when it, you know, if you get a situation like that. The other point, of course, is raises the question about the integrity of squads. One thing I haven't been able to find out about this arrangement in Germany is, do, for instance, Stuttgart, Werder Bremen, and Bayern Munich have their reserve teams in the third division. If they have really, really good seasons and they push up towards the top, now they can't be promoted, but if they push up towards the top, at what stage can their managers in the first team go, well, we'll have them and bring them through? Can they transfer them straight away, because like it's a reserve team, so like in England it's not a problem. You say, right, yeah, you're part of the squad, you're playing in the reserves, but you're part of, you're, I'm paying your wages, you're registered to me, over you come. Or are these teams effectively in that respect squads separate, so you then have to have a formal transfer process, which doesn't require any change of money, that's absurd, but have a formal registration service when the player leaves one squad to go to the other. So you look at transfer marks, for instance, at the beginning of the season, you'll see players coming into the squad from the second team. And you think, well, is that actually a formal registered transfer? And how does that work? And that would get around, I suppose, the issue of sort of like players coming to and fro. But yeah, it would be interesting, I suppose, if, you know, Liverpool reserves played Liverpool in the semi-final, and then, you know, end up sort of like stuffing the reserve team if they won with first teamers. That would be stupid. You couldn't make that up.
be interested to hear views of anybody out there. If you're your Premier League fan, would you like to see your reserves go into a lower league? Would you agree with Rafa Benitez that they should be in Championship or League One as a separate entity of a team? And if you're a lower league team, how would you feel if your team had an arrangement with one of these clubs? Do let us know. You can leave us comments on the podcast page itself, or you can go onto our Facebook page, facebook.com/twofootedtackle, and leave us a comment there, or just drop us a line, podcast@twofootedtackle.com. We'd really love to hear your opinions on this, and if we get some good ones, we might feature this again, because it's one of those debates that could run, and we'd love to hear your views on it. Anyway, that's about it for part one. Grab yourself a curry versus a Kolsch, settle in for part two, where we go MLS and Champions League crazy. Welcome back to part two of the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Let's head stateside for our weekly look at MLS. Now, Chris, even though we only managed 20 minutes, one man making the headlines again over in America.
Yeah, guess who? David Beckham is back. He was activated from the disabled list. Now, how much of an American term is that?
So I thought you were just making that up there for a minute.
No. So Bruce Arena activated him and then quickly told the press that it didn't really mean anything and that he wasn't necessarily coming back. But he did come on as a sub against Columbus at 3-0 up for the Galaxy.
I guess it's kind of appropriate because Beckham has almost bionic levels of recovery from injury. Because that was a nasty injury. I thought he'd be out for a lot longer.
Well, he's been out since, I think it was March he got injured, wasn't it? It's been a while. But he's going to come back and get a few weeks under his belt. Obviously, we'll help lead them into the playoffs. But he did get himself booked. He's got a habit of getting booked quite a lot, Beckham. It's something that hasn't left his game at all since when he was younger. It took him all of about 5 minutes. So he is back, and it can only be good for LA.
But, I mean, what's even better for LA was their result. They beat Columbus Crew 3-1, and that was the battle of the heavyweights, really.
Yeah.
They're both top of the table of their respective conferences.
It was, yeah. Such as the battle for Supporters' Shield is, it gives LA a huge advantage in the running, but MLS Cup is what it's all about, and there are teams in there who can do anything in knockout football, so it's far from done.
One team who, well, we don't know whether they're going to be into the playoffs or not, but if they do, they'll be certainly with a new management team, and that's Toronto. You know, they're sitting third in the Eastern Conference, looking like they may well get a playoff place, wild card probably. But they've sacked their general manager and their coach, isn't it?
Yeah, they have sort of slipped back into a slightly perilous position, but then they've tried to bounce themselves back into proper playoff contention, and then hope to get a few decent results in there by booting Preki and old firm straddler Mo Johnston.
Do you think it's a particularly good tactic for them to do so? I mean, it's
risky.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it seems risky from the position that they're in at the moment. It seems a very English thing to do, to sack your coach in that position.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah, it's a big decision, and I haven't really kind of read around enough to know exactly what the goings on. I would be surprised if it were purely a footballing decision. It may just be that they want to snag somebody who they've got in mind for next season and want to make sure that that's all done on the quiet before the end of the year.
Case obviously not helped by Toronto losing to DC United.
No, hilariously losing to DC United while I was very drunk and just looking at Twitter and watching the scores come in, and then Julius James pops up in the last 10 minutes to give us a rare win.
Another team that got a decent win was Philadelphia Union beating the Fire as well. I mean, that's not a bad result for them.
No, it's a decent result. Again, they're struggling a little bit. You know, they're probably not going to be caught by DC, but they might be. They've been on and off pretty kind of solid. You can't get relegated, so it doesn't really matter, but they've established themselves. They've got a few very decent players. Sebastian Latour's had an absolutely stonking season after I tipped him at the start of the season to be a good choice from the expansion draft, but it'll be interesting to see what they do next year, because it's going to be time to start pushing into the playoffs in what's going to be, by the way, an uneven fixture list again next year.
Yes, of course. So who are the expansion teams again?
Expansion teams are Portland and Vancouver, but they're going to play 34 games each.
Looking ahead to the fixtures this week, Toronto, well, they've got a good chance to try and bounce back from their disappointments. Obviously, the DC United loss and a goalless draw against the Fire as well last week. They've got Houston Dynamo, who we talked last week that they were poor. They've got even worse.
Yes, against the surprisingly piss-poor Houston Dynamo. They've had an awful season, the Dynamo, and it doesn't show any signs of improvement at all. And it's probably going to be a write-off now. And they're not going to do anything. I can't imagine that they're going to be that motivated to pick up any wins along the way.
Probably the game, if you're going to pick one to watch, I would probably go for the Crew against the Sounders.
It would be interesting because, as we've mentioned in previous weeks, the Sounders, despite their sort of relatively lowly position, aren't on such a bad run of form at the moment. So it's going to be interesting to see that one because Columbus are very, very tough to beat at home. So it'll be interesting to see if Freddie Montero and the boys could pick up a result there.
Also, Dallas play the Red Bulls, and they're on, I mean, they're in different conferences, but Dallas have picked up one more point this season than the Red Bulls, so if you merge the table, Dallas would be ahead of the Red Bulls. Interesting representation of the respective strengths of the two conferences, this one.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge week for Dallas, actually, as well, because I've got two games. It's probably Thursday probably falls into next week, strictly speaking, but yeah, they've got two winnable games at home. The Red Bulls obviously is a significant challenge, but Dallas have got enough about them to at least get a point there if they really fancy it. And it's going to be fascinating to watch them in the playoffs because they're not a team that's thought recently to be that strong, but you know they're in a very good position at the moment and they're more than capable of picking up wins.
So do you see the DC United renaissance continuing against away to Los Angeles Galaxy?
No, I don't, funnily enough. The Galaxy are miles away in quality from DC, and Beckham coming back is just going to be a painful experience for us, I think.
Right. Well, Chris will be on hand to report the pain, the agony, the ecstasy, maybe not next week. While Beckham returned in the States, so to Champions League football in Europe, there were some absolutely cracking games to open up with. James, Rangers versus Manchester United wasn't one of those.
No, Gary, it's a sign of a pretty awful game when the back pages are covering a nasty injury and not talking about a single minute of the actual football on show. So not an enjoyable evening all round, to be honest.
Give Rangers credit, though. They clearly set their stall out to come away with a point, maybe nicking one on the counter or on the break. And they did that as to the best of their abilities.
Yeah, I mean, there was a moment 20 minutes in, I was watching the game, and there was a bank of four on the edge of the penalty area and another bank of four on the edge of the D. So I thought to myself, it's going to be a long evening for Manchester United strikers if they can't get a goal pretty sharpish. And you're right, in a way, you looked at the Rangers team that arrived at Old Trafford and thought, well, they haven't got a hope here. You know, the 40-year-old David Weirs, the sort of the man that they're expecting to stop Manchester United strikers, what chance have they got? But it just goes to show that I think that defences these days, they can organise themselves to stop even the best quality strikers. I think we saw that at the World Cup, where, you know, teams that probably in previous World Cups may have folded and conceded, you know, 5, 6, 7. Actually, the much more sophisticated coaching, better conditioning, and perhaps certain aspects of refereeing and the rules have contributed to supposedly weaker teams being able to keep out strong teams. Perhaps that's an issue that may have contributed in this game.
Is that as good as Rangers can get, or can they actually build on this now?
Well, there's no reason why they can't do the same to Valencia away from home. And judging by Valencia's performance beating Bursaspor, that was 4-0 in Turkey, you've got to say, if Rangers want to qualify at this group, then grabbing points off Valencia is going to be the way forward. So who knows? I didn't give them a hope in hell's chance, to be honest, at the outset of the group stages, but a 0-0 draw at Old Trafford is nothing to be sniffed at. So who knows, Rangers fans, you may be getting knockout football again.
Chris, the back pages today absolutely full of Arsenal and Chelsea. Arsenal romped, and I think that's one of the few times you can actually genuinely use that word. They romped to a 6-0 victory against Braga of Portugal. Chelsea 4-1 against Gelina. Is that how you pronounce it?
James. Yeah, roughly. James will know.
Yeah, Gelina.
Gelina.
4-1 against Gelina. Back page of the Evening Standard that we've got here. Wembley's our destiny. Carried away much?
Just a little bit. No, Wembley is not your destiny, newspaper. great starts, probably expected. Okay, 6 is impressive, but it's 3 points. And a very solid away win for Chelsea, and exactly what we would have expected from them, really. And I don't think it necessarily suggests that they will be going to Wembley, although I happen to think one of those two teams will be.
Well, Arsenal have been here before, haven't they? Because they've had many, many good results in the group stages. 20 springs to mind, that they hammered them. And Braga, I mean, we're slight surprise at that scoreline there, but they've not got easy away trips. They've got Shakhtar Donetsk, Partizan Belgrade, neither of which are going to be particularly easy places for Arsenal to go, and you'd imagine that those teams wouldn't give them as much space.
No, they wouldn't. I wouldn't be surprised if Arsenal approach those two games quite happy with a point, or a narrow away win would be superb for them. Arsenal are a very capable side. I think they're going to make a worthwhile challenge in the Premier League. I think they'll probably do the same in Europe, and I don't think they'll struggle to get out of the group. But those two away games, as you rightly say, are going to be key, as well as the trip to Braga, of course.
James, who do you see being second in that group? Shakhtar obviously got off to a good start as well with a goal against goal victory against Partizan.
It's got to be Shakhtar, to be honest. On the eve of their Champions League opener against Partizan, they lost. Fernandinho broke his leg in a league match on last Friday, and I have to say that if that happened to another team in their group, Partizan or Braga, losing Fernandinho, essentially one of their major playmakers, a real stylish player, you wouldn't give them a hope. But Shakhtar have got a decent strength in depth. They've got, very, very good, one of the typical Eastern European teams that have managed to sign a big crop of expensively paid, fetid Brazilians. And they will, even despite that loss, probably take the second spot in the group for me.
Mm. Terry, a team who were, after about 20 minutes, chanting easy on their first trip into the Champions League, and then were pegged back and then some. Spurs ended up drawing 2-2 against Bremen. That was kind of very topsy-turvy. What did you make of that result?
I thought it was a typical Spurs result. I thought it was a typical Bremen result as well. I for various reasons I won't bore listeners with, I don't like Tottenham Hotspur. I'm from London, I support another London club, and it's my right to not like Tottenham Hotspur. But they are good value, it's got to be said. They've got a comedy manager, and they've got some cracking players. Terrific players, even, dare I say.
He didn't learn anything.
Nothing that he could have learned at Hackney Marshes, couldn't he? So, but Bremen are just, they are just, I mean, look, despite that sort of like very disciplined 0-0 result that we were talking about against Bayern, they are a knockabout team. They are an attacking side. And the only way they were ever going to respond to going 2-0 down at home was to chuck the kitchen sink in it. Or Marco Marin in this instance, who had a terrific game. He's a terrific lad. He's got two lovely feet. He's a terrific player.
How much did Spurs read into that result and to that performance?
Nothing. Nothing at all. There's nothing to read into it. There's nothing to read.
Nothing.
No. Well, I mean, I didn't watch the whole game, so I didn't have a good chance to have a look at see how they were laid out. But I would probably suggest that there is an art in Europe to closing out results like that, and they need to learn how to do that. And it is not, it's actually no reflection on Redknapp's, if to be objective about it, leave aside all the issues that there are with him and with that club. There's nothing wrong with going into your first Champions League game and coming away with a team, a senior, I would suggest, a very, very experienced European club like Werder Bremen, with a 2-2 result. And there's nothing wrong with perhaps getting a little bit carried away in the second half, losing your discipline, and then falling behind. I'm sure there are lessons to be learnt, but the key one would be, to develop a strategy that allows players to, keep their shape and that perhaps a little bit better, perhaps not get quite so carried away. But, you know, in a place like Bremen, I mean, like, it's a big stadium, there's a big noise being generated, you know, it's a floodlit game, the players are going to have the adrenaline pumping through their veins, you know, not their veins, obviously, but through their nervous system. that would be hideous. They'd probably all explode with that. Yeah. God.
Carlos Kyrgios would probably be able to prevent them being found.
Yeah, no. Tottenham players do not have adrenaline pumping through their veins, listening. You have any lawyers on behalf of them?
You have to say, though, that they are in a tough group. And should Spurs fans be worried? And should Spurs be worried that they've still got Inter Milan, they've still got 20, again, both of whom are you know, Inter obviously winners.
It's the first time for 20 in the Champions League as well. So they've only got Bremen, who are always beatable. They'll always be vulnerable. They will give you a way through. And Inter are in flux. We don't know enough about Inter to know what kind of season they're going to have. You would imagine that they should really be able to get through that group at a mild canter without having to disrupt themselves, but you don't know with absolute certainty. The group stage has yet to settle down, and we've seen a few odd results, and I would suggest the Twente Inter result was probably an odd one. But Tottenham have got an excellent chance of getting through that group, no question about it. But then, you know what, they shouldn't beat themselves up if they don't. It's their first time in the Champions League. You can't just expect to just pitch up somewhere and just, like, you know, be good, you know,
unless
it's Acne Marshes, of course, in which case, you know,
Chris,
that's where the real lessons are learned.
Chris, one team that certainly weren't playing on Acne Marshes, Barcelona. They destroyed Panathinaikos, and we were drooling over every single one of those goals that Barca scored.
Yeah, it's quite impressive, weren't they? Imperious, some might say. I think we picked out off air the two assists from Messi and Xavi were just stunning, as we've seen several times from Barcelona in Europe over the last few years. Just mouth-watering football.
And Messi himself had a fantastic
game. Yeah, I don't rate him, though. I've only seen him about three times, but he's not my type of player.
He had a dreadful season last season.
It's terrible. Yeah, awful.
Actually, funny enough, wasn't he at Hackney Marshes yesterday?
Yeah, he was.
He was
doing, presumably, some promotional work.
For a Stripe-based sportswear manufacturer.
Indeed. Just briefly, talk us through that wonderful fifth goal, because that was the one that I could watch again and again and again.
Yes, it was a sort of a trademark Messi 1-2 on the edge of the box, and then a little dink over the top to Dani Alves. It was wonderful.
Absolutely purring. Real, though, got off to a very good dance as well. Solid. Both Terry and James, you both saw that one. What did you make of their victory over Ajax?
It's a funny thing, this. My first point would be, and this is, you know, the major thing that I took away from the game, is Real Madrid played brilliant football. They had 33 shots on goal, I read earlier today, 15 on target. You can't really argue with that. But having watched the game, a lot of those shots on goal were from distance. It was the typical kind of flair approach of Di Maria and Cristiano Ronaldo of cutting in off the wing and shooting from 35 yards, and either it went over the crossbar or it went fairly safely into the hands of Martin Stekelenburg, who I would add had an excellent game in goal for Ajax. Again, to emphasise, between them, Ronaldo and Di Maria had 12 shots off target. So it was a dominant performance, but it sort of was symptomatic of Real Madrid's bad old problems of individual players out on the field feeling that they have to take responsibility at all times. And the ego sets in. And I think I was reading this week that Cristiano Ronaldo has started to be booed by sections of the Bernabeu faithful, precisely because they detect a hint of individualism about him, which they don't really like, which reminds them of the Galacticos era, which was a notoriously unsuccessful one for Real
Madrid. Someone should write about that.
Pardon me?
Somebody should write about that.
Oh, I'm sure there's something out there for someone. try and Google it. Possibly put my name next to it. I don't know. Terry, but did you differ in your attitude?
No, I completely agree with you. Yeah, I think that it exemplifies Mourinho's challenge that he's got at Real Madrid, because he must presumably have been brought in to assemble a unit to just go and just win, and even win at any reasonable cost. I know they're used to a certain variety of football there, but I don't think any of them will complain massively if Mourinho were to produce Inter 2 and go and win the Champions League that way. But he's inherited a squad that isn't like that, and I think he might have some problems convincing some of the senior players that's the way to go. And in fairness to those players, their instincts will be, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, his job at Manchester United was to take that team by the scruff of the neck and take a game by the scruff of the neck and shape it and turn it around and oftentimes, you know, kick it into submission. Those instincts are going to be difficult to sort of suppress, especially with a player with his ego as large as his. So, but yeah, no, I agree. I mean, they were wasteful. But having said that, you know, 2-0 against a decent side, Ajax, obviously not the team that they were, is still a good result. And if it's a shape of, if it's a portent for future doings, then Real will go far in the Champions League.
Mm. I saw last season's beaten finalist Bayern against Roma, which was an excellent game. And Roma had a spell at the end of the first half where they were pressing quite nicely, but the second half was all Bayern. They literally threw the kitchen sink and then some at the Roma defence, and eventually it creaked too much and relied on a wunder goal from Thomas Müller. The ball came to him on the right-hand corner of the penalty area, opened up with the outside of his right foot and just curled one round the goalkeeper. Second one was a free kick that Klose got on the end of. Classic Klose poacher goal as well in there. But from what I've seen of Bayern this season, they looked decent against Bremen, even though it's a 0-0 draw. They looked very good against Roma as well. The only question under them is, can they break teams down this season? And if Bayern can, then they certainly looked a force to be reckoned with, even without Arjen Robben on the pitch.
Well, when Robben's return will be key for them, but also what will be key will be Ribery's form. I think he's had a fairly quiet start to the season, so people will be looking to him to try and step things up a bit, but it's possible that he's struggling with his various off-the-field burdens, shall we say.
Mm. I had a question from the Equaliser blog for James. Asked over via Twitter, can you shed any light on the managerial situation at Cluj? What were the reasons for sacking? That's a Romanian club, CFR Cluj.
Yeah, Cluj, back in the Champions League after a year off. Listeners might remember in 2008 they were drawn against Chelsea and also Roma. So their opening Champions League group game in 2008-09 was a victory over Roma. I think it was in Rome as well. And they also held Chelsea at home to a 0-0 draw. So they are back in the Champions League and they beat Basel. But the story going into the game was that they're now 7 games into their domestic season and are, I think, 6 points behind the top teams. They're the big Bucharest teams, Dinamo Rapid and Steaua, who are all at the top of the Romanian league at the moment. They sacked their manager, Mandolini, who had led them to a domestic double last season. So hence the question from the Equaliser blog, why turf a manager who'd brought so much success? And also bear in mind, he'd only been there just under a year. They only hired him in November 2009. The answer seems to be that obviously the poor start to the domestic season is a certain contributing factor. But there was reports after the close of the transfer window that Mandolini had fallen out with a few of the players. And this sort of came to a head when the 25-man squads for the Champions League were named. And the manager left out 3 major players. One of them is a guy called Christy Budd, who you may think he sounds like a Hollywood actress.
I've seen some of our films, actually.
Yeah.
Hollywood actress, you say?
Well, a certain type of actress. Where she comes from is anyone's guess. But he is a striker, quite a prolific striker in the Romanian league, left out of the Champions League squad, and he gave an interview last week, saying that Mandolini had obviously got a personal problem with him because he didn't feel he'd been left out for footballing reasons. Likewise, they also left out somebody who may be familiar to trivia geeks and buffs like me and you guys as well. It was a guy called Sixto Peralta, who used to play for Ipswich, an Argentine midfielder. He now plays for Cluj, and he was also left out of the Champions League squad and is none too happy about it. And suspicion is in Romania that he'd fallen out with a few major players, and the owner and chairman decided to side with the players over the manager. So there's your answer.
Player power. Talking of player power, very briefly before we wrap up Champions League, I just wanted to mention Zlatan getting a double for Milan against Auxerre. How do you think Zlatan's going to do in Milan, Chris?
Well, he thinks he's going to do fine.
Well, I'm sure he does.
It's going to be a fun one to watch, because he is a player of such quality, and he can do things that barely anybody else can do. But sadly for him, that kind of thing includes doing his taekwondo practice on teammates in training, and basically being a bit of a snidey sod. So it's all going to be down to his attitude and down to how Allegri can fit him around the other four strikers that they have up there, including Inzaghi, who's obviously going to be back up to the other four.
Fascinating stuff. Right, we'll leave it there. But like a faithful old dog, we'll be back in part three to bark on about the Premier League. Part three of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. And just before we get to the bit that Chris doesn't want to talk about, I'll let him talk about something I'm sure he does. Tooting and Mitcham against Walton Casuals.
Wonderful.
In the FA Cup.
Yes, in the FA Cup first qualifying round. It was a 4-1 victory, and it was pretty good. Tooting started slightly slowly, eventually played their way into the game, and quality showed in the end. And Walton were quite unpleasant in their reaction to beginning to lose.
And you've got Staines in the next round. Home, isn't it? But it's like Staines are a tough team.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult. I think Tooting quite evidently haven't quite bedded in the new era yet. And I think it's going to be really, really tough. I don't particularly see us getting through that, especially given that we had a decent run last season in the FA Cup, and to do it 2 years in a row against teams that are bigger and better resourced is going to be a big ask.
Just to come in, sorry, you don't happen to know if Sean Alloway is still playing for Staines? I seem to recall goalkeeper used to play for Leeds at one time, 16 years old, was signed for £2 million from Reading.
If you ask me in 2 weeks, and I'll be able to tell
you. I will do. keep an eye out for him. He's a bit of a Leeds legend, but for all the wrong reasons. One of Peter Ridsdale's many extravagant purchases.
Can I also just interject? I know you were talking about Croydon Athletic a couple of weeks ago, and I did say that Croydon Athletic had two of their next two fixtures postponed by the Ryman League and forfeited their place in the FA Cup, and were largely expected to just disappear. But they have announced that they will be fulfilling their fixture against, I think it's Avonlea Town on the 24th, which is a Friday. At the Keith Tuckey Stadium, so they appear to be on the way back, which is interesting and encouraging news for people who like their non-league Croydon style.
Well, we will keep an eye on that, because
we'll have our 3 points then.
Yeah, fine, whatever.
Banter aside,
we're probably going to be relegated anyway. So
I love it. Lower league banter from two teams that probably majority of our listeners have only heard about through this pod. Just very quickly, just while we're still in the FA Cup before we get into the Premier League, I picked out a couple of FA Cup fixtures that I think, one north, one south, that if you're around, are worth going to in the next round. Cray against Ebbsfleet in the next round, which should be a very good tie. Ebbsfleet obviously relegated last season, and Cray, one of the oldest teams in the world, actually.
They would claim second.
They would claim second. And the first oldest team in the world, Sheffield, have got Northwich Victoria. Ooh. Which should be a very tasty tie, I would have thought. Well worth, if you happen to be in the Sheffield area, that's probably a very good game to get along to. I'd highly recommend
Sheffield
that
now?
One.
Where are Sheffield in the pyramid?
They are, ooh, I think they're one step below Northwich, although I might be wrong. So should be home advantage for Sheffield. Northwich would probably be the team who you'd expect to win that, but that one should be an absolute corker. And that would be my tip for a game if you're going to see one. Okay, right, let's get into the bit that Chris really doesn't want to talk about. Stoke versus Villa. Last gasp winner for the Potteries team after Villa were frankly rampant in the first half. Are you still sulking?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm kind of used to Villa doing this to me, though. So we're terrible for last minute goals. But it was quite difficult to take, actually, because I was quite disappointed with the overall performance. For the last 15 minutes of the first half, we were absolutely stunning and we should have been away. From the moment that Tony Pulis kind of jogged up the touchline at the start of the second half, there was only one way that game was going to go.
I actually didn't think Villa played that badly at all. I mean, this is from a neutral's perspective. I thought they had a decent performance in them, and it looks like it won't take much to shape them into a very competitive team, assuming Julier's the right man for that.
No, I think we'll probably be okay, and I think Julier will do a decent job, and he has certainly got some excellent resources at his disposal, but it's the kind of result that we need to shake off, and we do it a lot, and we tend, and we have done since before Martin O'Neill, sit back on a 1-0. And it's obviously partly down to the team coming on to us, but we do invite them on a little bit, and it tends to cost us, and it has done against Stoke on several occasions.
And you've got another bruising encounter next against Bolton.
Yeah, home games against Bolton have been fantastic in recent seasons, and we've scored a lot of goals, and a lot of our goals of the season have come against Bolton at home. They are a slightly different proposition this season. It's the last game before Julio takes over. And I'm relatively confident. I think that they're a good side, but we should be better.
James, if we're talking games of the weekend, probably none will really top Everton 3, Manchester United 3. Two injury time winners, injury time goals for Everton. And David Moyes furious at the end as the referee blew up as Everton were launching yet another attack.
Yeah, it's funny that you sort of it was a bit of a slip of the tongue saying injury time winners. They really did feel like injury time winners for Everton until obviously the referee called time before Jagielka had the chance to possibly put Everton in front right at the death. But I think that looking back after the event, David Moyes probably would feel that he's probably been a bit harsh there. The referee clearly had blown the whistle probably as close to the halfway line as he possibly could have done at that juncture, and time had run out. So otherwise, a fantastic game of football. It will go down as one of the better games in this Premier League season. And it's funny, Manchester United, it seems as though they had the game completely wrapped up. And on another day, we wouldn't be talking about that game, this game at all, as being, you know, a classic. It was only really a burst of 3 or 4 minutes, you know, in added time, that turned it from a pretty routine Manchester United victory into suddenly a stunning draw that's, you know, shaken the Premier League and the newspapers. So that's the swings and roundabouts of Premier League football, I suppose, isn't it?
Sitting behind Manchester United in fourth place in the Premier League is Blackpool. According to the table I've got.
No, it's definitely right.
It's definitely right. I was just had to double check on there. Fantastic victory for them against Newcastle. I don't know if any of you saw Mark Bright in the Metro claim that this was down to the new, brand new 4-3-3 formation. I think talking about it as a formation that hadn't been seen before, as opposed to Ian Holloway trying a new. Either way, both completely incorrect.
Well, that's Ian Holloway, the great innovator of English football, isn't it? Get him after Fabio leaves in 2012. Please, let's have the Superman Holloway as our.
Can we have Mark Bright?
Well, imagine that as a team on the bench. You know, a major football championship. I wouldn't fancy that at all. Actually,
you mentioned Holloway though as an innovator. I mean, he is actually though a manager. He's gone out. He's watched a lot of football in his time off. He's come back. He's applied what he thinks is the aesthetics and the tactics he's seen from the continent, and said, you know, I'm going to put them to Blackpool. We're going to play wonderful attacking football. And here against Newcastle, 2-0 victory. It's paid off.
The first point is about Holloway. Yes, you are right. I did joke about Ian Holloway, and it's partly because his personality, certainly, you know, in the kind of mainstream media, is one of a joker, and I think he invites it upon himself that people don't necessarily take him all that seriously. But underneath that, there's certainly a really strong footballing brain at work, and it's no coincidence that Blackpool are where they are as a result of Ian Holloway's appointment. The second point is regarding the game at St James's Park, and whilst it's nice to characterise it as a great Blackpool victory, Newcastle had chances to take that game. It was a brilliant performance by Matt Jilks in the Blackpool goal. And it's the second game that you've asked me about, and the second time I'm going to say this. On another day, it would have been a Newcastle win, but such is the Premier League at the moment, anyway, amongst the kind of chasing pack. So that's how I'd sum that game up, I'm afraid, Gary.
Mm. Terry, Blackpool have got Chelsea this weekend, which they've already been turned over by Arsenal. Holloway's probably not going to abandon his attacking philosophy there. Last week on the pod, Tim Morgan said that Blackpool are one of those teams you could see just getting a result against Chelsea or one of the bigger teams very unexpectedly. It is at Stamford Bridge. Do you see them possibly doing that, or do you think it's going to be Chelsea all the way?
Not at the Bridge, no. I think I find Chelsea very boring to watch at the Bridge because they're just so, it's just such one-sided, they're just so powerful. I can't see that being anything other than a home win. I'll concede that it could not be a stomping, but yeah, I mean, the easiest thing actually would be to say, actually, oh, it'll be a stomping because of, you look at the way Blackpool play, and you'll say, oh, they'll be too open and they'll leave gaps and they'll leave spaces. But again, I think that's to underestimate Holloway's, one, the Blackpool players, but certainly Holloway's tactical nous. And he is not going to necessarily go there and say, right, lads, we're going to have a go, you know. I don't think it'll be quite as. I think it'll be a little bit different from that. So it'll be an interesting fixture, but it's really tough to see past a home win there.
Mm, okay. Chelsea had West Ham. They saw West Ham reasonably comfortably last weekend, 3-1 at Upton Park. And Chris, there's a little bit of disconsternation amongst the West Ham supporters, or a certain group of them, for this weekend, because this Saturday is Yom Kippur. I think I incorrectly thought it was last weekend on the last pod. Apologies, any Jewish listeners out there. It's definitely this Saturday, and it falls on the same day as West Ham's visit to Stoke City. Grant and Tal Ben-Haim, the defender, have both said they will not be going. Obviously, they'll be observing Yom Kippur. And a few West Ham fans seem to be, some of the comments that I've seen in the papers and online, they should dock him wages, this is the beginning of the end for Grant, puts him under huge pressure. To me, that feels very, very hard to have any sympathy with those West Ham fans at all for those views, which this is a religious festival. No.
Yes, shut up, few West Ham fans.
I must say, coming in, you may not know this about me, but I'm actually Jewish, and I must say I have an enormous amount of sympathy for Avan Grant in this situation. He's really caught in a situation that, you know, a lot of Jewish people are caught in, of having to honour certain, you know, religious or kind of... perhaps, you know, they have a spiritual affiliation which they want to honour on this particular day, which is, after all, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, versus an expectation that they have to go about their normal affairs and normal life in a way that you know, pleases everybody and suits everybody. Grant really has taken a decision which ultimately is probably the right one for him personally, and probably the right one because he would be absolutely slammed in Israel, certainly, for working on Yom Kippur. I'd echo that sentiment, Chris. It's shocking to think that essentially there are West Ham fans who are encouraging some kind of racial discrimination if they are attempting to enforce some kind of docking of wages on a man just for honouring his religious beliefs.
I don't think Avram Grant will have had a second thought about it, and it's absolutely right. There won't be a shred of guilt. He won't lose sleep over it. He will probably be 100% comfortable with his decision and all the thought.
Mm. And rightly so.
Absolutely, yes. Well done, Avram Grant, on that. But Stoke City, Chris, is a game for West Ham. I mean, West Ham still no points this season. It's going to be a tough visit for Stoke. Stoke now have got their win behind them after that win against Villa.
Yes, it was a very decent performance from Stoke, actually. Very solid, and you know, they created the chances they needed to, particularly when it came to the crunch at the end. Second home game in a week. It's going to be very, very tough for West Ham, and I can't see them getting anything out of it.
Last week on the pod, you said whose leg is Wolves going to break this week? Coming back to haunt you slightly, I mean, that's really bad luck for Bobby Zamora.
I have no recollection of saying that at all, and I only got reminded of it about 5 minutes before we came into the studio, so I apologise profusely to Bobby Zamora.
A good win for Fulham, though, over Wolves.
Yeah, it was. Obviously, going behind was not the best start. But they seem to have found someone who's capable of stepping into a part of what Bobby Zamora can do, who cropped up to score a couple of pretty decent goals, actually, you know, pretty straight. Yeah. Knows how to strike a ball straight, as was mentioned on another podcast. Fantastic result. Wolves are starting to look like a Premier League team this season, so far anyway. And Fulham will be rightly delighted to take 3 points.
Mm. Terry, we won't sort of say too much about Arsenal's victory. I mean, over Bolton, very, very well done. They've now scored 10 goals in 2 games over last week. They've got Sunderland away, which should be a very interesting one this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it'll be interesting to see if Jean's sort of settling into the Sunderland team continues. I think that that's... are they playing the two up front? How's it working? Are they playing Bent and Jean together, or... how do we know what that...
Well, John came on as a substitute in the last game. I imagine he'd probably have done enough to convince Steve Bruce that he probably fancies a starting place. But, you know, last season, when Ken Wynne-Jones was fit and fancied it, he was playing up front with Bent as a 4-4-2,
well.
So perhaps that's what they'll do. They'll try and have John as a target man with Bent
that'll be really,
off him.
Really tasty. I mean, Arsenal are obviously in such great shape and are experienced and have the wherewithal to not be too taken aback by the midweek rigours. An interesting game.
And then you've got on Sunday, Terry, Manchester United against Liverpool, which I think in a couple of seasons ago, everybody had been going fantastic. This one, you've got a very odd situation. You've got an out-of-sort Fernando Torres, which might give Nemanja Vidic a slightly more restful night the night before.
Liverpool
not quite still sort of gelling yet. Hodgson's still saying, give us time here. We're still trying to put this team together. Obviously, expectations there's huge. Manchester United stuttering a little bit, so it's perhaps not the firecracker we'd expect.
No.
But then... you know, Manchester United Liverpool is always an interesting game.
When Hodgson took over at Fulham, it took him a long time to set that team up, and they sailed really close to the wind. In fact, towards the end of the season, because he took over mid season. I'm a great believer in Roy Hodgson, partly because he's from my hometown of Croydon, and so therefore I feel a connection and dare I say a bond with him. But I think also the absence of Joe Cole, although this is a difficult one, because Joe Cole may not actually be that, he may only become a peripheral player. But what we haven't seen is whether or not he is or is not central to the way Liverpool play. And that kind of, all that has to be determined first before we really know what Liverpool do. Fernando Torres looks like a guy who could do with a couple of weeks' holiday. Genuinely, he looks like a guy who could actually be sent away for a couple of weeks and say, look, you know, you're not injured, but just go away and like, you just have a holiday. He's one of those Spanish players who's had to deal with injury and a huge amount of work that he's had to put through really since Euro 2008. It's been pretty much non-stop for him. And because he's carried the additional injuries and the additional burden of responsibility at Liverpool because of the tremendous issues that Liverpool have got, and also to try and realise their ambitions, forlornly in their case, realise their ambitions, that he could probably use a break. United are curious. Certainly I take James's point about how a modern Champions League managers, and Walter Smith is an deeply experienced manager, are able to condense their play sufficiently to be able to stop Manchester United from playing. But I also think about there was a time, perhaps that long ago, when inferior teams were either hiding to nothing by going to Old Trafford and attempting to congest the final third of the field, so that United couldn't actually work. That United were good enough to find a way through. And I think it's curious that Ferguson said that he regretted not playing Berbatov because he clearly needs some lock pickers. I think that it'll be a different situation. I think United will be improved this time around, and in fact, I think we'll probably bounce back. And also they've got a bit of licks to pay back to Liverpool, so that could be quite a tasty encounter. I mean, they're always quite tasty. I don't think it'll be the festive football that it's traditionally is, but I mean, it's a derby game, and derby games are usually dramatic, aren't they?
A game that I think could be quite entertaining this weekend, James, is Everton against Newcastle.
Yeah, I mean, Everton, obviously the great entertainers at the moment, and likewise Newcastle, when they're good, they're fantastic, as we saw when they won 6-0 against Aston Villa. I'm sorry about that. Joey Barton going back to Goodison Park. You know, you've got to think that that is going to cause some aggro. And it'll be a good game. Definitely, Gary. I agree with you.
Do you think Spurs are going to suffer from a Euro hangover? Because they did last time when they came off the back of Young Boys. Sorry. That was completely... I wasn't even thinking of that one. They've got Wolves this time. It's kind of classic game that Tot Spurs losing to Wigan last time around at home after their Champions League game. They had another tough Champions League game. Do you think it's kind of actually finding their feet now at the moment?
Yeah, we've already spent part two of the pod talking about Harry Redknapp and his failings, so I won't necessarily go into that. But it is the mark of an inexperienced team in Europe that they'd come back off a big European tie, especially away from home, and just are unable to lift themselves for what looks like a routine Premier League game at home to what would be regarded as a struggling side. If I was going to be putting money on that game, I'd put it on an away win.
Just before we wrap up, I'll put to the Midlands man, the Midlands derby of West Brom against Newcastle. Not Newcastle, where did that one come from? West Brom against Birmingham.
Midlands derby at 3 o'clock on a Saturday.
Yes, indeed.
All that often.
Are you looking forward to that? If you happen to be up there, would you have chosen to go to that?
Yeah, I probably would. I think it would be a decent game. West Brom, plugging away, doing okay. Blues, I think, have been excellent so far this season. I think they're going to continue to do very well, and I would put serious money on an away win.
Now they sit in fifth at the moment. Do you think a European place is not beyond them this season?
I'm not sure they can go the season at the kind of pace they've been going at the moment. I don't think they have the depth, and I don't necessarily think that the players who've been performing so well are actually of the quality that they're showing at the moment over a whole season. So I think they'll fall short of Europe, but a top half finish should be absolutely comfortable for them.
Okay, well, we'll round up for there. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, you can check out various places of Two-Footed Tackle. Twitter.com/Two-Footed Tackle if you want to shout football at Chris during the week on Twitter. Facebook.com/Two-Footed Tackle if you've got anything you've heard on this pod and you want to discuss or want to ask about, do leave us a comment on there. www.twofootedtackle.com. Loads of writers' opinion, what have you. We've got a great team on there. Redesigned site. If you haven't had a look, do go there. Leave a comment on some of the pieces, get involved in the discussion. You can email the pod, podcast@twofootedtackle.com. Thank you to James Appel.
Thanks very much.
Thank you to Terry DeFellin.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, as ever, to Chris Nee.
Thank you.
And thank you, dear listener. We'll be back next week.
Twofootedtackle.com.